We are in the season of truth claims of all kinds, general election truth claims, promises made, truths described, history retold in various forms, lots of claim and counterclaim. So much so that the BBC have a reality check person who they interview often, kind of every morning on a number of the news programs, who is utterly annoying to me for some reason, because I don't really think they're reality checkers. They're kind of setting themselves up as the arbiters of truth, but it's all rather disappointing normally, because they just say, well, there's this and there's that. They're kind of like lawyers in a way. But there's a desire from that kind of thing to say, well, let's try and sift through all these claims and let's try and get to the actual reality. There's people seem to be lying. There's people who are claiming that other people are lying. And it's very difficult to believe what they say and what they report. Also, the great exciting thing on Netflix, amongst everything else, is the new series of The Crown. I don't know if you've been binge-watching that, you Netflixers. But the Crown's just started. It's series 3, I think. And what I find myself doing watching episodes of The Crown is constantly on my phone. Not particularly because I'm bored, although I have fell asleep in every single episode so far. But it's also because I'm kind of wondering, did this actually happen? Any of you experienced that when watching The Crown? You kind of see something about Harold Wilson, or you see something about Prince Philip, who speaks to the astronauts privately, you know, the ones who land on the moon. You think, did that actually happen? And then this kind of sordid stuff about various people having affairs with various people. And you think, did that actually happen? And sadly, mostly it seems like it did. But you're on the internet looking, did that actually happen? And you're doing a bit of fact checking. Are there other reports? Is it just on Wikipedia? Or are there real people who actually claim that these things happen? Because truth is important to us. We want to better distinguish, to work out the difference between made-up stuff, dramas, lies, and truth, reality. Truth is really important to us. We instinctively know it is. And Christmas could be a bit like that for you. Another set of truth claims. Mythology. Wishful thinking. Did it actually happen? What actually happened? Are the people who told me about it telling the truth themselves? Did it happen at all? Did it happen like this? And we're going to begin to look at that. Of course, all through this season, we're going to be looking at the story, but we're going to look just at the first four verses of Luke's gospel to kind of get us into the story and get us thinking about how reliable this story is. And it's based on the Advent book, one of the Advent books we've suggested. Repeat the Sounding Joy. It's the one for the 1st of December, and then we'll preach the ones for the relevant dates as we work through. So Luke 1, 1 to 4. First of all, let's think about the who wrote it. The writer of this part of the Bible is Luke. Actually, he doesn't tell us that at the beginning, but we work it out from putting together Luke's book here, the Gospel of Luke, with Luke's second book, the book of Acts, and putting that together with some other things, we can kind of work out who wrote and what it means. From the Acts of the Apostles and from the letters, we know these things about Luke. We know he was a doctor. We have no clue whether he could write legibly or not, like doctors often can't. But we do know he was a kind of professional guy who wrote really good Greek. People who know how to read really good Greek will tell you that. He wrote really good, orderly Greek. And maybe because he was a doctor, he also focuses a lot on healing stories. And often the word for healing is very similar, almost the same as the word for salvation. So he does a lot of talking about healing and thinking about salvation, about being saved, about being rescued as he thinks about healing. Interestingly, he was a Gentile, meaning he was not a Jew. Probably the only Gentile who wrote any of the New Testament, interestingly. He might have been a Syrian. Some people think that. A Syrian, not Assyrian. Might have been a Syrian who became a follower of Christ when the gospel came to his area. And he started following Jesus. And as part of that, he started hanging out with Paul. And about halfway through the book of the Acts of the Apostles, he's there with Paul, it would seem. And he works with him, seems to be his main companion, a really good friend of his. And through that time, I guess, he put together all the stories, as we think about in just a sec. Luke's gospel is pretty much essential reading at Christmas time, isn't it? Along with Matthew. They're the two gospels. We've got Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but Matthew and Luke are the two that speak about the birth stories of Jesus. The only two books really that do that. And Luke's going to make some truth claims, but as we work our way into the truth claims, we just need to sort of debunk some of the things that are not necessarily true or not true at all. So here's some truth claims. Maybe you can shout out whether you think they were true or not. There was a star when Jesus was born that guided the wise men and the shepherds. True or false? Pardon? Only the wise men. Well, if you could be a little bit more enthusiastic with your truth and false in the next few. I'd call that a murmur and a mutter. Well, we don't know for sure, but the only thing we do know for sure is that the star guided the wise men. Of course, it could have been around before then. Could have been around the moment Jesus was born. But when it comes to the shepherds, they're not told, follow the star to find the baby. They're told to look for a sign of a baby wrapped in swaddling clothes and laid in a manger. That's what they're told to look for. And you would have thought if there was a star for them to follow, the angel might have said, oh, and by the way, there's this massive star that will guide you as well. Jesus was born in a kind of hotel. What do you reckon? False. That was very definite.
You asked for it.
Yeah, I know. And I'm celebrating it. Yeah. Well, it's another one of those that could be true, but may not be true. There isn't actually a word that usually got used for the word for inn that's used about the birth of Jesus. You know, it says there was no room at the inn. The best translation is to say something like there was no guest room or there was no place to stay. And probably by tradition, Joseph and Mary would have gone up to Bethlehem and stayed with family. There wasn't lots of travel lodges and something similar for them to stay in. Kind of makes for a nice story and makes an interesting part of the play. But you could still kind of knock on the door of a family member and still get put where you get put. But probably not an inn, because it's not the word for inn that's used. But a guest room in a family room, maybe some relatives of Joseph or Mary. And there wasn't any room in the guest room. So the next thing is, Jesus was born in a stable. True or false? False. Ooh. Anyone think it's true?
True.
Well, it's another one of those that might be. What do we know about where Jesus was put after he was born?
A manger,
yeah. Do we know about any animals being there? No, we don't. So it could have been that they're in a guest room. There isn't a room in the guest room. So they get kind of dumped in a sort of room where animals and other things are kept, including a manger. Could have been that someone went and got the manger. You know, a baby's been born. Where should we put him? So they go downstairs, upstairs, across stairs, whatever, get a manger and bring it through and the baby gets put there. So we don't know whether he was born in a barn. All we know is that he was placed in a manger, a feeding trough for cattle, which probably would have been got from where the cattle were. So I think it's all right to have a few cattle and a bit of a stable at the Christmas story. I know you know these, but it's worth just going through them. There were three kings who visited Jesus. Yeah. There's only a couple of you getting any better. The rest of you are still murmuring. There were three gifts, as said. That's all we know. And we don't know about them being kings. We know about them being wise men, magi, people who study and research astrology and all kinds of scrolls and learning. So we don't know whether there were three or lots more, but we do know there were three gifts. So there might have been just three people, or there might have been many more, or indeed less, but more than one. Jesus was born on the 25th of December. Oh, good at that. Nobody has a clue, so don't be too excited about saying false, because it might possibly be. I only actually realized this recently, that the reason December 25th was chosen, I always thought it was just because Constantine, because it happened from about the year 300. I thought he just wanted to take over pagan festivals. You know, people often say, talk about Yuletide. Yule is to do with the winter solstice, shortest day. And December the 25th is obviously just after the 21st, so it's getting a little bit longer day. I always thought that was a bit weird, suggesting that we just took that over, because in my experience, the 25th isn't much lighter than the 21st is. So, you know, if I was a pagan worshiper, I wouldn't have quite figured out that it was all over and the summer was coming. I think I'd wait till, you know, February or something. Because there's something about the science of the way the darkness works that actually, after the 21st, it changes a bit and gets a bit darker in the mornings or something like that. And they didn't have accurate watches, so I don't have a clue why the 25th was the thing. But apparently, a lot of people in the early church thought that Jesus was conceived on the 25th of March. And that's where the 25th of December comes, because it's 9 months after that. People also thought that Jesus died on the 25th of March as well, interestingly. So we don't know. There's people who speculate, well, shepherds wouldn't have been out in the cold and all that kind of stuff, but nobody has a clue. By the way, the reason part of the church celebrates it on the 9th of January has nothing to do with arguments about that. It's just because they have a slightly different calendar. So their 25th of December is on the 9th of January, if you know what I mean. Because they went with Julius Caesar's calendar, and we went with Pope Gregory's calendar. Do you feel educated? A little bit educated? Okay. Final myth, true or false? Father Christmas was there. Somebody say true. Apparently, and you can hear this on the podcast, because Mark and Josh didn't believe me, I think, 6% of millennials think that he was. 6 out of every 100 millennials think that Father Christmas was there. In fact, Father Christmas wasn't anywhere. But that's a whole other myth that I'm not getting into today. It's more controversial than talking about speaking in tongues. It's talking about Father Christmas, to be perfectly honest. So we're trying to unravel and get to the truth claims, and that's what Luke's about, this doctor, this professional person, this careful, serious person. What does he do? What does he do? Well, he writes two books, the book of Luke and the book of Acts, and he dedicates them, it says, to Theophilus, both of them. Theophilus, almost certainly a real person. It could be a kind of concept, lover of God or something, but probably a real person, probably a rich person, and almost certainly a Christian from what's said. And you would write to a rich person. Often a rich person would commission a book or a set of scrolls to be written, and then they would commission it and you'd write it, and then because they had lots of money, they could get lots of copies made. And so that was quite sensible of Luke to do that. But more than just the kind of commercial aspects of getting it out there, Luke's writing it because he wants to help Theophilus be certain about things. And his writing, we're told, is based on a couple of things. First of all, careful investigation. You see that in verse 3? With this in mind, so you'd have certainty, I have carefully investigated everything from the beginning. So he writes his books based on careful investigation. He gets his magnifying glass out and he looks carefully into what actually happened. He looks with great care at the records. There were probably some records already written down, testimonies of what had happened in the life of Jesus. They were probably around already. And probably Matthew and Mark used some of them as well. So he looks at those. But also, I'm sure he interviews people as well. There were loads of people around he could talk to. Mary's there at the beginning of the book of the Acts of the Apostles. And no doubt he talked to Mary or somebody close to Mary and found out all about the stories of Jesus' birth. So he carefully investigates. He compiles. What a fun job that would have been, talking to all those people and kind of understanding from the beginning, from the birth of Jesus, right from the beginning, right through to the end, to the resurrection and Jesus returning. And then what happens after that? He investigates all of that and puts it all together. talks to the eyewitnesses, looks at the scrolls, compares the stories, captures the testimonies, and he does that so he can write an orderly account. Luke's probably the most chronological of all the Gospels. Like, he tries to write it in the right order, put everything kind of in an orderly way. That's his book, that's his style, writing in an orderly way. And that's his final report for Theophilus. Why does he do it? Well, he tells us. He does it so Theophilus could be certain about the facts. See that in verse 4? This is why I'm doing it, Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught. There are things that have been handed down to Theophilus. There's things he'd learned from eyewitnesses, maybe verbal accounts that he'd heard, people talking to him about what had happened. And so now Luke's going to give him this book and say, look, this is the backup. This is the fact-checker stuff to make you certain that what you've heard is actually true. In those moments of doubt, here's a book that will say, yes, this actually happened. This is actually true. And he could rely on them. So certainty about the facts, but also, he says, I've written it so you'd have clarity about the meaning and the significance. Theophilus is going to learn a lot of things. But more than anything, he's going to learn about the significance of the coming of Jesus. That it's the coming of the king and the kingdom, and it's the coming of salvation. And so Luke, right at the beginning, says, many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us. And Luke, like the other gospel writers, are about what actually happened, but they're about the significance of what happened. And the significance kind of points forward, like, what's the situation now for people who believe in Jesus? So it points forward. But always the gospel writers also look back and say, what's happening now is fulfilling what was spoken about in the past. So right at the end of his book, Luke 24, verse 44, Jesus is talking to his disciples and he says this, this is what I told you while I was still with you. Everything must be fulfilled that is written about me in the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms. Points out in the book, the daily reading book, that fulfills a word like filling up to the full. And it's kind of a nice idea that you have an outline in the Old Testament. So imagine getting a pencil and drawing an outline of something, and then later you fill it in with color and more detail. And that's what's happening. So in the Old Testament, you've got the outlines. You've got loads of big outlines being drawn. And then Jesus comes along and he fills in all the detail. He colors in all the detail. He makes clear things that weren't quite clear. There's this amazing plan going on that he's fulfilling. There's a plan starting right at the beginning. There's Eve in the Garden of Eden. She's eaten the fruit. Adam's eaten the fruit. It's terrible. It's devastating. There's going to be death and destruction and fracture in the world. The world is going to be broken from that point onwards. And yet, God makes a promise that through the offspring, through the seed of Eve, there's going to be blessing. There's going to be crushing. There's going to be restoration. And Jesus will fulfill that. There's outlines in the history that happens after that. There's an understanding about how broken the world is because people die. But then kind of out of the blue and out of this rich, idolatrous place, a guy called Abraham gets called by God and starts putting faith in God. And here's another outline, an outline about how God's going to bless and an outline about faith and what faith looks like and how faith brings to salvation as we trust the promises of God. And then through Abraham's descendants, a family starts and they become a nation in Israel, in Egypt, and they're in slavery in Egypt. We've just been thinking about it in the book of Exodus, haven't we? And God saves them out of their slavery in Egypt. And it's another big outline being drawn about how God will save and rescue and bring people through to the promised land. And also about how God's going to deal with sin through a sacrifice as they have to make lots of animal sacrifices because of their sin. Another outline being drawn. And then as they get established in Palestine, kings come along. Perhaps the best king of all, King David. And there's another outline being drawn. there is such a thing as a good king over the people of God, where the people are safe and secure and happy. And then the outline seems to get kind of distorted because the kingdoms break up into Judah and Israel. And the stuff we've been looking at on Sunday evenings, Jeremiah the prophet is talking about sin. And yet, even as he talks about the sin of the people and the judgment of God, there's some more outlines being drawn because he talks about a new covenant, a new agreement, an agreement we're going to think about in a minute when we celebrate the Lord's Supper. A new covenant's going to come and it's going to write the law into our hearts. And the book of Isaiah is going to talk to us about a servant who will come, who will be the Messiah, the king promised by God. But the servant will suffer and the servant will die and he will die in place of his people and he will rise again. And there's another outline being drawn. And then Jesus comes and he fills it all in. Not like me colouring in, not like a child colouring in, who are generally better than me colouring in. Jesus comes and he colours in all those outlines with perfection. And suddenly it becomes clear, this is how God's going to save. This is how God's going to rule his people. This is how God's going to make a sacrifice for sin and be just and the justifier. He's going to still be holy and yet he's going to forgive and welcome people into his family. It's being fulfilled in Jesus. It's very exciting. And that's what we celebrate all year round, but especially as we have opportunity to look at these stories about the birth of Jesus. It's about fulfillment. It's about being part of such a bigger story. So what? First thing, be sure of the facts. Be sure of the facts and be sure that they are in fact, facts. Theophilus and us need to be sure. You need to be sure about the facts that what Luke's talking about is actually true. Why is that important? Two reasons. One is, it's really hard to believe. And the other is, if it's true, it's completely life-changing. So that's why it's important to know whether it's a fact or not. Number one, it's really hard to believe. You think it's easy to believe about a virgin birth? You think it's easy to believe about a man who went around performing miracles? Or easy to believe that this man was perfect in all he said and did and thought? You think it's easy to believe that God would punish his own son, God the Son, on the cross? You think it's easy to believe that Jesus rose again from death and was seen by so many people? It's not. So you need to know that it's actually true. Because lots of doubts will arise. Maybe if you're not a Christian this morning, it's part of the reason that you're not a Christian, because you're skeptical. You're thinking, well, you know, Jesus obviously existed. You know, it's hard to imagine a case of Jesus not living on the earth, but all the other stuff, I'm not so sure. And I want to encourage you this morning to look again, to get your magnifying glass out again and look at the scrolls and see that it's true. It's true. It's backed up. It's worth saying as well that what we have in our hands here, in our Bibles or on our phones, we can be certain that it's the same as what they had at the beginning, as Luke actually wrote his book out. I think I might mention this before, but we had the fun of going on a couple of tours of London looking at heritage stuff, and one of those parts of the tour was to go to the British Library and to look at the Codex Sinaiticus, which is from about 300, year 300, maybe 400. And what's exciting about it is it's a whole Bible which is there and was discovered a little while ago, and it's the whole Bible. It's the same as the Bible that we have. That's really important for lots of reasons. It's really important when you're talking to Muslims as well, who might claim the Bible's been corrupted, but it would have had to have been after that, and there's no evidence and so forth. But it's really important for you to realize that in terms of big books like that and then lots of other scrolls and manuscripts and bits and bits. You can put the whole thing together and say there is such an overwhelming weight of evidence that what we have in our hands in Luke's gospel and the other gospels are what they wrote. So we've got a reliable record, and if you put then those books together along with the letters in the New Testament, you've got such an overwhelming set of evidence to say this is true. It's part of the story, and it comes to fulfillment in Jesus, but it's a reliable story. It's not a made-up story. You know, it's really good to be cautious. If you're not a Christian this morning and you're still asking questions, that's a good thing to say, can I trust the Bible? Can I trust what's written down as being what they wrote? And can I trust what's written down as being true? And I want to encourage you by looking at Luke's words this morning that it is true. Luke, and indeed the other gospel writers, carefully investigate, compile, put together an orderly account. They put together the history. It's true. So what are you going to do with that evidence? Because if it's true, and I know it's hard to believe, but if it's true, it transforms lives. It has such overwhelming significance. Because it means that the story of the history of the whole world, and particularly the history of the human race, it means that the story of the human race finds significance, finds hope, finds meaning in Jesus, finds fulfillment in Jesus. We live in a broken world. It's been broken since Adam and Eve didn't trust the word of God. The world we live in is broken. But Jesus fulfills the promises of God to mend it. And if it's true, just like Theophilus, we need to put our faith in the word of God, the story that God brings. So understand the significance. And lastly, Christians, be confident in your witness. Be confident in your witness. Just remember, as Christians, that the weight of evidence is actually on your side. There's a spiritual battle that people don't easily believe. And that's why we pray, and that's why we urge, and that's why we help each other, and that's why we work hard to explain. But the weight of evidence is on our side. We haven't just got some kind of message in a bottle, some tiny little fragment that we found that we're trying to build a whole story around. You haven't got some sort of story that a bloke in a pub told you once and you're just retelling. You haven't got some sort of something on the dark net or on the not so dark net that you don't know whether it's true or not, some little sort of Twitter ramblings of someone and you have no clue how to verify it. What you've got is a reliable body of evidence in the Bible. So be confident. Don't be arrogant. Don't think people are going to believe because there's a whole spiritual battle to go on, but be confident that what you've got is true and useful. Sometimes we just feel like we're the underdogs. You know, like we've got some crazy fable that we're having to defend, but kind of in our heart of hearts, we think, I don't know whether this is true or not. It's one thing that I've learned from going on the radio quite a bit in the last few years is that, you know, the nicest possible way, virtually no one has hardly a clue about Christianity, and no one really has a clue about the possibility that it might be true, or the arguments that it might be true, or the weakness of all other philosophies. Because most people are just kind of living their lives and just inheriting all the nonsense that they're kind of seeing around them. They're not kind of thinking deeply. They're not thinking, you know, how do I know this is true? How do I know evolution is true? You know, how do I know that I evolved in this way and I'm going to turn into fertilizer and worms in the future and there's no other hope? They're not kind of thinking deeply, most of them. Most people are not philosophers. You know, they're just plumbers and solicitors and nurses and stuff and just getting on with life, being mothers, being children. And so we have to break into that, but we don't break into that thinking, oh, I've got a really weak argument. We break in saying, let's just patiently and prayerfully explain this to you, because it's true and it's transformative. So be confident, Christians, in your witness. What we're talking about all year round, what we're talking about in this Christmas season, is true and reliable. Luke, for one, wants us to know the certainty of the things that we've heard. And so he writes an orderly account after careful investigation. And so we take Luke, and we take Matthew, and we take Mark, and we take John, and we take the rest of the New Testament letters, and then we put them together with the outlines of the Old Testament, and we say, we have such a great story. I was thinking this week with someone that it's just wonderful that God gives us a story. You know, we love the stories at Christmas time, and as we've talked about, embellish them a little bit, because we know stories help people understand reality. We're all kind of living stories. We're all living our own story, and we like to hear stories. And the wonderful thing about the Bible is that it's a big story that comes to fulfillment in Jesus. God doesn't just give us a series of propositions. This is true, this is true, this is true, this is what you got to do. He gives us a rich story with loads of characters in it, all of which show us God is amazing. God is transcendent over everything. God is perfect and holy, but God is loving, and he shows his love finally and fully, fulfilling all his purposes in Jesus coming. And so we got truth and we got a story. So be confident in your witness. And let's enjoy this Christmas season, this unfolding of the revelation of God in Jesus Christ.